Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select Eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Macron resign. That has been the call from massive protests around France for about a month now. It began as a protest against a fuel tax hike, then quickly spiraled into a rebuke of a president seen as out of touch with working people. Macron finally acknowledged the protest when he spoke to the French people on Monday night.
When violence exists, of freedom stops. So calm and the republican order must be enforced.
But these protests aren't just a spontaneous explosion of chaos. It is the upwelling of deeply held frustrations, emblematic of core challenges faced by many Western economies. So this hour on Point, political turmoil in France and its echoes across Europe. And you can join us. What do you make of the recent political upheaval in France and across Europe? Do you identify with these demonstrations going on? And what do you make of Emmanuel Macron's response? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And a little later this hour, while a gas tax proposal really sparked those protests in France, there's a carbon tax on the table in the U.S. Congress. So we'll speak with U.S. Representative Charlie Crist, who's co-sponsored the first bipartisan climate bill in Congress in a decade. That's a little later this hour. But first, let's go straight to France and begin in Paris. And joining us now is Richard Locke. He's Deputy Paris Bureau Chief for Reuters. We have a link to Locke's reporting at onpointradio.org. Richard, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
It's good to have you. So I want to talk a little bit, about how Emmanuel Macron has been responding to these protests in France. But there's other news in France that we should begin with, and that is this shooting that happened this week at a Strasbourg Christmas market. What more do we know about what happened there?
That's right. Once again, very disturbing scenes in France, which has been beset by a wave of militant attacks since early 2015. There is now a massive manhunt that is underway, some 600 police officers scouring eastern France, the area around the city of Strasbourg that lies on the border with Germany, trying to find the suspect, a 29-year-old Strasbourg-born man, who was known to intelligence agencies as a potential security threat. He was deemed to have become radicalized while serving time in jail for petty crimes. He's now on the run. That has led to the French authorities raising their threat level to the highest they have. But so far, he remains elusive.
Okay, so a lot going on in France now with this manhunt, the latest thing. So thank you for the update on that, Richard. So let's now just turn and talk more about the upheavals overall that have been going on in France for a month now. President Emmanuel Macron did indeed speak to the French people on Monday, finally responding to four continuous weekends of major protests. So here's a little bit of what Macron said on Monday night. Macron said it was at first an anger against a tax, and the prime minister responded by canceling and removing all the increases scheduled for the start of next year. But this anger is deeper. I feel it is justified in many ways. That's what Emmanuel Macron said on Monday. So, Richard, tell us, really, what are protesters saying that has brought them to the streets for several continuous weekends now?
Well, Macron is absolutely right in what he says there. The problem for the French president is it's taken him too long to work it out. This is a movement, a grassroots movement that sort of bubbled up through social media, through Facebook, ostensibly, as you said, at face value over fuel taxes and the price of diesel at the pump. But it has morphed into something deeper. It's tapped into a disenchantment that is felt particularly keenly outside of France's big cities towards Macron and his administration, and more particularly towards his reforms to liberalize the economy. These are seen as reforms that favor the wealthy. He, for example, scrapped a wealth tax and imposed a higher social levy on pensioners. So reforms that favor the wealthy and are seen as leaving the poor behind. Very early on in his presidency, he earned himself the moniker President of the Rich, and that has stuck. He's struggled to shake it. And really, that is what this Yellow Vest movement has now come to represent. It's an expression of anger against the establishment, against the urban elite, and against globalized forces.
Right. So these are expressions now that are sounding increasingly familiar with every passing month and year in recent times. But tell me a little bit more about the state of the economy in France right now, because just to underscore again, like it may have been this proposed tax that brought people to the streets, but it wasn't just that. I mean, that was, to use an awkward metaphor, that was the match that really lit the tinder that was already there. So, I mean, what is the state of the economy for working people in France? Because externally, you know, looking here from the United States, we hear about France's universal health care, about their supposedly generous pension and work benefits. So what is it that working people are feeling that has caused them such frustration?
I think they're feeling that the government doesn't have their back any longer. There's a feeling that more needs to be done to protect French jobs, to protect French workers from the growing clout of foreign powers such as China and India, that the government needs to be doing more to put money in the households, in the pockets of low-income households, and not just permit unfettered sort of globalization, unfettered market forces at the expense of the worker.
Mm. Well, Richard Locke is Deputy Paris Bureau Chief for Reuters, speaking to us from Paris today. Richard, thank you so very much. All right, well, let's turn now to Laura Haim. She's joining us via Skype from Paris. She's the former campaign spokesperson for President Emmanuel Macron. Laura Haim, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much, Magda. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you. So tell us how, I mean, the Emmanuel Macron did acknowledge what he called those left behind in his speech on Monday. But, I mean, how out of touch is he with the people who have taken to the streets of cities across France?
I was just listening to Richard, and I would like to make a point and to answer to your question. Of course, there's a disillusion. The Yellow Vests are extremely disappointed by what has been done in the past, not only year, but in the past 40 years. So this anger, you can feel it. But you have also, and I think for your viewers, you really have to understand what's happening in France. You have also the extremists, which are playing, who are playing with fire. And it's not most of the Yellow Vests who are breaking and looting shops in Paris, who are burning cars. You have almost militias, far right and also far left, who are coming to the streets, who are joining the movement, who are trying to take advantage of what's happening in a European democracy. And that's also something that you have to say when you're talking about what's happening in France. Yes, President Macron did some mistake. Yes, on Monday night, he acknowledged his mistakes, but in the same time, he's trying to reform a country which needs to be reformed. And you have, in a very sensitive economy, in which you have a lot of unemployment rate, extremists playing with fire.
So point taken about the extremists, as you say, who are perhaps exacerbating the effects of these public protests now. But to the very point you were just making, though, you were saying that in addition, there's 40 years of French economic policy that is also bubbling over now. Tell us a little bit more about what is it that's happening amongst the lives of working people in France that has so galvanized them at this moment against President Macron.
They feel they're not heard, and that's something that you can see all over the world at this moment. They're working really hard. They want to make more money. There's no more money. Reforms should have been done 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 10 years ago. And each time there was a strike, the president and the political people didn't push for the reforms. So the President Macron was in charge. President Macron was in charge. Came and tried to do some changes. But those people do not see what they call their pouvoir d'achat, their power of spending money in their wallets. They don't see more money in their wallets. They see more taxes. They see this fuel tax, and they're taking the car to commute. And when you're making $1,200 a month, when you have $100 more to spend on your fuel, on your gas, this is extremely important. They feel that the political class is fully disconnected from them. And that's the problem. And it's not happening only in France. Mm. It's happening, I think, all over. And what's happening in France is this anger, which is now in the street, and it's quite difficult to quiet down the situation.
We have about a minute to go before we have to take a quick break here, but it sounds like from what you're saying that they are not wrong to feel these things. Does it make sense to you that perhaps people would have a less than positive reaction to President Macron's, his signature move to cut the wealth tax in France?
I'm speaking as a journalist to you, and I met some yellow vests. There are a lot of polls which are showing that 80% of the French people 3 weeks ago well supported the yellow vest. And most of the yellow vests are saying things that most of the people are saying now. We have to adapt to the globalization. We don't know what to do. We want to work, but we don't want to be taxed 60 or 70%. We really want to work hard, but we want to make money. So, when you're listening to them, when you're listening to those women who are 55 years old, they have been fired and they cannot find a job. When you're listening to some of the people, yes, in my opinion, some of the revendications, some of what they're asking for, they're right.
Laura Haim, stand by here for just a second because we have to take a very quick break. We're talking about political unrest in France and what's really driving it. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about a month of political unrest in France and what's driving it and lessons that we can all learn from it. And I'm joined today by Laura Haim. She is with us from Paris via Skype. She's former campaign spokesperson for President Emmanuel Macron, also a journalist as well. And I wanted to play a little bit of tape here from the voice of one of the organizers of the Yellow Vest protests, as they're being called in France, because on Saturday, NPR's Scott Simon spoke to Christophe Chalençon about what it would take to stop the demonstrations.
We're not asking for Mr. Macron to step down or to dissolve Parliament. That would plunge France into chaos. We just want Mr. Macron to start talking to the people, to talk like the father of the nation, and not like the president of a startup. He has to tell us that he understands us, that he hears us, that he's going to change course. But he seems incapable of that. He used to be a banker, and bankers only think about numbers. They don't think about people. People have to become the focus of politics again.
The voice of a translator there telling us what Christophe Chalençon, the organizer and organizer of the Yellow Vest protests, said to NPR on Saturday. Laura Haim, is there a fundamental conflict between what the French political elite believe needs to be done to modernize the French economy versus obviously what the 80% of people you were saying before the break who agree with the Yellow Vests, what they feel the nation needs? Is there a fundamental conflict there?
Yeah, there's a fundamental conflict, and there's also a communication problem. And I think on Monday night, the president acknowledged that he did some mistakes. It's not the same thing to be a candidate than to be a president. When you're a candidate, you go more easily, you meet more easily people, you can try things. When you're a president, sometimes you become prisoner of the bubble. In any case, as a journalist, I want to tell you that I think President Macron in the past year did some mistakes, and that now he acknowledged that he has to speak with his heart, he has to be close to the people, he has to see what's happening on the field, and he's fully able to do that. He did that during the campaign. There was a very tense moment 1 week before the election. He was in a factory, the Whirlpool factory. People were screaming at him. They were on strike for many, many months. And he came to meet them and he talked to them for 2 hours. And he convinced them that he wanted to do something for France. Mm. I think he has to do that again. And what is interesting in this crisis is to see how people feel disconnected by the people they put in power. I'm very much interested, personally speaking, about the Yellow Vest, who were saying to me, we voted for this president and we disappointed. And I think at this moment, you cannot disappoint people. You have to be really, really careful when people who voted for you are telling you we are disappointed. Mm-hmm. And then again, you have this anger, which is building up, which is completely exploited by the extremes. And I would like to say to your listeners, to the people who love France, and I know that you have a lot of people who come to France, who are saying, oh, it's a beautiful country. It is a beautiful country, but it's a country which has, at this moment, an identity problem, uh-huh, and which is showing to the world how a democracy is trying to adapt to globalization.
Right. Well, so this is the familiar pattern now that many nations are grappling with. So Laura, stand by for just a moment, because I'd like to bring in Mark Vail into the conversation. He's joining us today from New Orleans. He's professor of political science at Tulane University and author of several books about Western economies, including Recasting Welfare Capitalism, Economic Adjustment in Contemporary France and Germany, and also Liberalism in Illiberal States, Ideas and Economic Adjustment in Contemporary Europe. Mark Vail, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you very much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
You know, so we're trying to pack in, basically, as Laura said, sort of 40 years of French economic policy into a very short conversation. I want to acknowledge that. But tell us here. I want to get straight to something. It seems as if Emmanuel Macron has followed a pattern that we've seen over at least a generation, if not more, in the context of globalization, that in trying to modernize his nation's economy, he, you know, attempted to reduce the tax burden on the wealthy. But as Laura was saying, working class French people still feel as if the burden was then shifted to them. What is it about modern economic theory in the West that makes it, you know, prohibitive to think, shouldn't we flip it the other way around to correct for the ills of globalization?
Say a few words, and real very quickly, in response to Laura Haim's comments, I think it would be a mistake to conflate this with trends across Europe. Yes, in part, this is a European story. It's partly a story about discontent with labor conditions and access to disposable income. But I also think it would be a mistake to dismiss this as a footnote that's being exploited by political extremes. I think that's an excuse, not a reason. I think the point that this is a broad historical context is important, but we have to understand what that historical context means. France in the post-war era adopted a statist model that deliberately excluded labor. And that was a matter of political inclusion, but it was also a matter of equitable sharing of the fruits of economic growth.
Can I just ask that, when you say deliberately excluded labor for non-economists, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. One political economist, Andrew Schoenfeld, famously described the post-war French statist model as a conspiracy in the public interest between big business and the state. And that was a model that always viewed labor as with skepticism, and it viewed them as an obstacle to reform and to modernization. And this is obviously a discourse that we still hear today. And the distribution of income between labor and capital became more and more unequal over the course of the 1960s. And as you said, we've seen this before. We saw it in May to June 1968, which started out as a student protest and quickly exploded into a protest about incomes and living standards, among many other things. The other thing you have to remember is 1995, Alain Juppé tried to force through a pension reform that was extraordinarily unpopular. Strikes shut down the country for the better part of a month. Again, so this is part of an old pattern, but it's part of an old pattern that has not to do so much with globalization, but about a French model for economic growth that has excluded labor. And you also have to remember that this is not taking place in a vacuum. It's taking place in a European context in which the European currency is based on a regime that holds down growth, is basically deflationary, and prevents the kinds of growth that would lead to the increase in wages and employment that French workers are now demanding.
So, Mark, hang on here. Laura, I know you wanted to jump in there, so go ahead and respond.
Yeah, I want to respond to something which I think, and I disagree, unfortunately, or fortunately with your guest, but I think the extremes are playing a big role. And I disagree with what you're just saying about the fact that they didn't play a big role. I mean, I'm in Paris. I have been there in the past months. I was in the street. I saw paramilitary militias at Arc de Triomphe breaking a lot of things. They were extremely organized. They were not the yellow vest. They were dressed in black. I saw a far-left militia, which is extremely violent, which is called the Black Blocs. We don't know if it's far-left, anarchist, or far-right, but they break everything. They break the banks. They break a Starbucks. They went to the symbol of capitalism, and that was not the Yellow Vest. The Yellow Vest movement, for their majority, is condemning those violence. And what is new in what's happening at this moment in Paris? It's the anger of the Yellow Vest movement. Those regular people who are coming to say we cannot take it anymore, who are joined by those extremists. And furthermore, when President Macron spoke on Monday, 3 minutes after the end of his speech, the far-left leader Jean-Luc Mélenchon came on French TV and did a response, like just after the State of the Union, you have a response. Yeah. And that was exactly what happened with a far-left leader saying, I'm not happy with Macron, the revolution should happen.
But Laura, can I just jump in? Laura, if I just may just jump in here for a second. I just want to ask you a quick question, Laura.
Yes.
I mean, I take your point about, I mean, you're there and what you are seeing happening in the streets of Paris, but isn't the broader point that I actually think you're also trying to make here, that the extremist on the left and the right in France would not have been so emboldened to be so public about their demands and even their acts of violence had there not been this stage set of broad-based discontent in France. I mean, you're the one who told us that 80% of the French people agree with what has brought protesters to the street.
They agree with what it says, but they completely disagree with the violence, and people are tremendously suffering for the violence. The people who have small shops in Paris, it's 2 weeks before Christmas, are losing a lot of money. I just think that it's not, and I agree with you at this point, it's not an ordinary movement. It's not like in 1995. It is a movement with anger, but also with extremists who are playing with fire.
Right. Well, so Mark Vail, let me turn back to you, because I really want to get your sense of, you know, what would it take? What are the beginnings of how to change the economic model that you were talking about, the statist model between between the state and French business, to modernize the economy in a way that meets the needs of the French people who now feel compelled to protest?
Right. Very quickly, in response to Laura Haim's point, I don't doubt for a moment that there's a lot of violence going on in Paris. I've seen it myself. I'm not there at the moment, though I have been recently. I'm well aware also of the dynamic whereby extremists take advantage of protests that start out for other reasons. But I think, as I said before, it would be a mistake to reduce this sort of movement to that, a point that Ms. Haim seems to be making herself. With respect to your question, Magna, I think that the French have always viewed the state as the engine of economic growth and economic modernization. I think it would be a mistake to take the government's claims at at face value, that these reforms would magically solve the unemployment and distributional problems that France is suffering from. But France has, partly by its own design, been subjected to a lot of constraints on public expenditure and public investment that are part of European Economic and Monetary Union, of which France was an early architect, of course, which are now precluding the kinds of public investment in consumption, in public infrastructure, in public goods, and in economic growth that really has been this French standard recipe for promoting economic growth. So I think we're conflating two things here. One, the use of reform, and I put that word in quotation marks because often that is a euphemism for cuts to social benefits and labor rights, which is part of what the Yellow Vests are upset about, and investment in public goods and in public economic – and in economic growth and in public incomes. And I think that's really where the French need to be focusing their attention. Macron made some, I think, sort of vague gestures in that direction by promising to raise the minimum wage and reduce some social security tax burden and suspend this fuel tax. But that is a pittance compared to the kinds of investment that are necessary to get France back to a robust rate of economic growth that would be felt by the ordinary citizens that are now feeling their pocketbooks pinched to such an extreme degree.
You know, we just have a couple minutes left in this conversation, and I want to at least get one or two callers in here if I can. So let's go to Jeremy, who's calling from Racine, Wisconsin. Jeremy, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to know if there's any numbers in regards to the heavy taxes in France in correlation to the social programs and welfare programs they have in the state. And could we as the United States take a lesson learned from France by drawing a direct line to, say, the state of California and their heavy burden on taxes on their citizens as well, and how people are beginning to leave the state to other places to live because affordability is just getting too out of hand for them. Primarily based on high tip taxing. So if they could just touch bases on those numbers, that'd be great.
Yeah. Jeremy, thank you for your call. Mark, go ahead.
I can speak to that very quickly.
Sure.
I mean, I think the point about California is a much more complicated point. It has to do with the real estate bubble. It has to do with all sorts of other reasons for high cost of living out there, not least the influence of Silicon Valley. But to speak to Jeremy's point about taxes, I don't think there's a story here at all about taxes being too high in general. We have to understand that the taxes that fund social benefits in France are very different. They're shared social contributions that are cut equally between employers and employees, much like we fund Social Security. We're not talking about general income taxes for the most part. Those social contributions are high. They're an average of around 20% of a normal worker's wages. But if you think what you get for that, you get universal health care. You get subsidized publicly available child care. You get generous unemployment insurance. You get general defined benefit pensions, which are almost non-existent in the U.S. At this point. So I think the lesson here is not that taxes are too high and economic problems result. It's that the kinds of taxes that you raise and what you invest that money in has differential effects based on the institutional environment that you find yourself in.
Right. Well, Laura Haim, we have just a minute or two here to go. From your view there in France, having worked on President Macron's campaign and now, you know, talking to people who are protesting in Paris, I mean, what do you think, what does the president have to do in the next month, 3 months, in order to both satisfy the demands of protesters and set the French nation on the right path?
He has to lower the unemployment, which is at more than 9% in France. And in my political experience and journalistic experience, he definitely has to speak to this other France, which is in the street. Mm-hmm. He has to go there. He has to talk to them. He has to establish a dialogue. He has to peace things. He has to show them that he's not arrogant and that he loves them. It's like a couple. It's the story of a love story between a president and his people. And at this moment, a lot of people do not feel the love of the president. It seems very simple, but you know, the French people are very affective people. They're very affectionate. And they need to feel that someone who has been elected by them or who is president understands them. And I think President Macron has really to do that.
Mark Vail, we've just got a minute left. Is he capable of doing that,
you think? I don't know, actually. That's an excellent question. I think it's worth pointing out that Macron comes across as imperious, out of touch, arrogant. But this is not just about Macron. This is about a pattern of executive leadership in France in which the way in which the state is concentrated concentrates authority at the center already creates an environment in which people are prone to view the state as aloof and unresponsive. Macron's personality, his demeanor, his way of dealing with the public has exacerbated structural limitations with respect to the French state's responsiveness to the public that were already there. They're not new. His demeanor, his arrogance, his unresponsiveness merely makes those problems worse. So I have my doubts about whether or not he can change in a meaningful way.
Well, Mark Vail is a professor of political science at Tulane University. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mark.
You're most welcome. It's been great. Thanks.
And Laura Haim, former campaign spokesperson for President Emmanuel Macron and a journalist there in Paris, speaking to us via Skype. Laura, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk about the proposal, a bipartisan proposal for a carbon tax here in the United States. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Introducing Batiste Sweat Activated and Touch Activated Dry Shampoo. With breakthrough technology that absorbs oil and releases bursts of fragrance whenever you sweat or touch your hair for up to 24 hours, it's the ultimate hair care for girls on the go. Try the newest dry shampoo that's activated by you. Batiste, the future of hair care is here. Buy Batiste dry shampoo online or in store at your nearest retailer.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So we've talked about the fallout from France's latest attempt at imposing a carbon tax and obviously the deeper economic discontent that's driving the protests there in France right now. So what would you think, though, about the fact that at this moment there's a carbon tax on the table in the United States Congress? Does that surprise you? Well, the recently introduced Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act is the first bipartisan climate bill in Congress for a decade. To be frank, it probably has a close to zero chance of going anywhere right now, but it could set a framework for how the next Congress approaches climate legislation. And we want to hear from you. Would you support a carbon tax? Now, in a moment, we're going to hear from Democratic Representative Charlie Crist, one of the bill's co-sponsors. But joining us first from Seattle, Washington, is Kate Yoder. She's news editor for Grist, an online environmental journalism magazine, and we have a link to her reporting at onpointradio.org. Kate, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us a little bit more about the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. What does it propose to do?
Yeah, so the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act would put a $15 per metric ton fee on carbon dioxide, and that'd be put on fossil fuels, and then that would rise $10 per year. So it would actually scale up fairly fast. And that the net revenue from that would be given back to households in America in the form of a check as a rebate.
Ah, so okay, so we as individual Americans and taxpayers would be the beneficiary of this carbon tax.
Yeah, that's the idea. I mean, it could also, you know, rise gas prices at the pump, but the idea is that that money would be given back.
Okay, so but you've written how you basically see this bill as in this Congress, which we only have, a couple weeks left in, is DOA. Now, why?
Yeah, I mean, I think next year it's going to be the same case because the Republican-controlled Senate really isn't going to be receptive to a carbon tax. And, you know, President Trump obviously wouldn't go for this either.
Okay, so not much, not lacking the key support to get it into an actual law, but nevertheless, is it not significant though that this is the first bipartisan climate bill to make it into a bill format in Congress in a decade?
Yeah, I mean that's a really big deal, and there are a lot of reasons to try to put something out there, a carbon tax legislation, even if it's not likely to pass. That could be, you know, a signal for bipartisan appetite for climate change, or it could be kind of putting out a template or a testing ground to kind of take control of the narrative of climate policy and try to kind of shape what climate policy looks like going forward. And it could also be kind of gauging public reaction.
Ah, okay. So a couple of key ways there then how it could help set the tone of a conversation for maybe more realistic legislation in the next Congress.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think most Republicans in Congress don't talk about climate change much, but, you know, many of those who did just lost their seats in the recent midterm elections. So I think this bill, one way you could interpret it is that it's a signal in a way that bipartisan action on climate change is still possible, even though the current administration is really hostile to it.
Okay. You know, we have been focusing on Republican resistance to the concept of a carbon tax. But you're there in Seattle, where just in this past midterm election, a carbon tax proposal in the state of Washington failed, despite having the support of, for example, Democratic Governor Jay Inslee there. What happened?
I think it's a pretty complicated picture. I think obviously people tend to be a little bit resistant to taxes. Polls show that a lot of people like them in the abstract, especially in Washington, but they're not always happy about implementing them in real life. So Initiative 1631, I've been following for basically all year. Mm-hmm. It came out of sort of a 10-year collaboration between environmentalists, as well as groups representing communities of color and labor groups. So it wasn't just something that was, dreamed up in an academic institution by an economist. It kind of came from a lot of the people who are being impacted by climate change.
Okay. Go ahead. Because I was just going to say, so then why? I mean, it failed by more than 12 points, right? That was the gap.
Right. I mean, yeah, I think one thing is people are resistant to taxes. The other thing is that oil companies spent, $31 million to kill the measure, which is the most that's ever been spent against an initiative in Washington state history. So, there are a lot of factors at play there. And, it's a complicated policy. I think putting that in front of people, they might not be able to kind of wrap their heads around the details and how it's really going to help them and help the world. So
$31 million was spent by the oil and gas industry to kill a carbon tax proposal in the state of Washington. But on the
other hand, this is where it gets a little confusing for me, because on the other hand, I'm seeing that regarding this, the federal proposal that's in Congress right now, there's a quote here in the Miami Herald from Ted Halstead, who's the CEO of the Climate Leadership Council. That's a group comprised of oil companies and other businesses, saying that the introduction of the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act provides a clear proof of concept that a conservative-inspired carbon dividends framework can attract bipartisan support, because they're looking for the fact that he says it's no coincidence that the first bipartisan climate bill in nearly a decade is based on carbon dividends, a plan that returns revenues to the American people and appealing to all sides of the climate debate. So is the oil and gas industry, is there something they see in this bill that they like? Is it in exchange for, I don't know, fewer regulations or what?
Yeah, I mean, there have been some plans over the years that have been supported by, you know, Exxon and Shell and other fossil fuel companies. So this new proposal from Deutsch prevents new regulations on carbon dioxide if it was implemented for like a full 10 years. So the EPA wouldn't be able to make new rules limiting it. Other, you know, more conservative.
So can I just jump in here?
Sure.
That sounds like a pretty big deal. Like saying that the EPA cannot make any carbon regulations for 10 years if this bill passes.
Yeah. I mean, the idea is that it's going to have a big enough impact that wouldn't be necessary, but that's definitely a concession for conservatives or environmentalists.
Okay, because the bill says that it aims to reduce carbon pollution by 40% within those 10 years, which would outstrip even the goals, I believe, that the Obama administration had.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it has potential to be pretty effective.
Okay. Potential to be pretty effective in practice, but again, as we've been talking about, the political potential perhaps is lacking. I want to actually just get a couple of callers in here if I can. Let's go to Rebecca, who's calling from Bettendorf, Iowa. Rebecca, you're on the air.
Hi, Meg. This is Rebecca. Thanks for taking my call. My husband is active duty military, so we've been all over the world. And we've paid carbon taxes in other countries. I think that our country would benefit from this. Perhaps it would encourage people to use public transportation more. We're rural here. I wish we had a better public transportation system here. So if that carbon tax would then help fund better public transportation, that would be fantastic. Mm. I think your speaker's right that folks are resistant to change. I think back to the recycling issue. We could do a much better job with recycling, but we're doing better than we were 15 years ago. So I think that this carbon tax kind of falls into that same category.
Yeah. Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for your call. Let's get a different view here. Roald is calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Roald, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to emphasize, I guess, the education piece and that people, once understanding this, would, I think, support it. I think one key part might be just the simple equation that if I drive, say, 10,000 miles a year, what might I be expecting to spend extra on this fee? And then also, what might my rebate be, being that I would be, say, a normal user versus a airline or a much larger user?
Yeah. Well, Roald, thank you so much for your call. Let's get an answer to that question from the co-sponsor of the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. Representative Charlie Crist joins us now. He's a Democratic congressman from Florida's 13th congressional district. He's with us from Washington. Congressman Crist, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
It's good to have you. So you just heard Roald there asking what I think fundamentally is a question of, is it possible that if, and I know we've been talking about why it's a big if your proposal gets anywhere in Congress, could it actually—
Let's hope so.
Yeah. I mean, but could it have the effect of ending up being a slightly increased burden on the people who are least able to afford it? Would it translate to higher prices at the pump, for example?
I really don't think so. Obviously the purpose is to address climate change. And I think all of us can agree that it's a real and present danger. It's a problem that we in Florida see up close and personal, if you will. One good example of that would be the recent Hurricane Michael that hit Florida's panhandle. It started out as a tropical storm, wasn't expected to intensify much beyond that. And then as it came north in the Gulf of Mexico toward the Florida Panhandle, it intensified rapidly, almost to a Category 5. So we see evidence of this, far too often. And then the recent wildfires in California as well. And so the idea is to put a fee on those who create the utilization of carbon dioxide to the point that it's warming the planet, causing this problem, contributing to the destruction. And it hurts us environmentally. It hurts us economically. It hurts us in so many ways. The obvious intent is to curtail that kind of activity and that continued contribution of carbon dioxide.
If I may just jump in here, though, is there anything in the bill? You know, I'm thinking about sort of market-based solutions for environmental issues that have worked in the past, like cap and trade. When we were talking about we were really focused on trying to reduce the chemical inputs that lead to acid rain, for example. But the key thing about that is, though, is that there was a cap that the federal government, right, kind of ratcheted down year after year. Is there any such thing in your proposal on this carbon tax? Because if not, then what difference does it make? I mean, because what is stopping companies from just passing on the cost of the tax to consumers and citizens?
Well, I think that you're looking at whether there's some kind of penalty that would exist. And I think the penalty here is that there is this fee, $15 for the initial year, then gets added to by $10 thereafter, as long as they are continuing to emit carbon. And the caller who asked the question becomes the beneficiary, because those funds go through the Department of Treasury and are remitted to the citizens of America, like your caller, like other consumers around the country. So in essence, I would argue that those people, the consumers like you and me and your caller from Wisconsin, will end up benefiting and not being penalized. This is really aimed at having the polluter pay and having the consumer gain, because through no fault of their own, these kinds of conditions are happening around the country.
Congressman Chris, let me ask you, a little earlier with Kate, who's still with us, and I'll come back to you in a second here, Kate. But Kate was talking about how there's resistance to the idea of a carbon tax from some members of the Republican Party. But I'm also seeing, Politico just recently had a story about how perhaps there's also a resistance among some Democrats, right? I mean, incoming Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been calling for a Green New Deal, for example, where a carbon tax would only be a tiny part of that New Deal. And Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon is saying that, hey, look, if a carbon tax can't pass in his neighboring state of Washington, it probably has no legs nationally. Are you concerned that there's maybe a reduced enthusiasm for a carbon tax amongst Democrats as well?
No, I really don't think so. what your comment about Representative-elect from New York, Ocasio, doesn't sound like she's objecting to it. It sounds rather like she'd like to add to it and expand the effort. And that's not a bad thing. And so, and just because a particular state decided not to support it, we have bipartisan sponsors on this bill already. Initially, there were three Democrats, two Republicans. Now we have three Republicans. So I think that the obvious nature of what's happening with climate change throughout America and the world, for that matter, is that people are seeing it, and the evidence of it is undeniable. And I think less and less you'll see people saying or, touting the view that, well, it really doesn't exist or I don't believe it. Because, the weather indicators are so obvious and so clear that it's hard to refute. Just in Florida alone, I live in the Tampa Bay area, and so I represent a district that happens to be a peninsula, Pinellas County. And, as you drive around, it's bordered on one side by Tampa Bay, the other side by the Gulf of Mexico, and I've lived there most of my life. But in the last 5 years, the rising sea level is apparent. It's obvious. You can see it with the naked eye and witness it. And another example down in Miami-Dade County, I think President Obama was down there a number of years ago and giving a talk about this issue and said, here in Miami-Dade County, you have situations where even when it's not raining, you're getting flooding. And that's because it's coming up.
Yeah.
And so the more Americans see this around the country, I think the more pressing and obvious this issue is, and the greater the importance and support will become. And in this case, it's on a bipartisan basis. Let's face it, Magna, you know, with three Republicans, three Democrats sponsoring this bill now in the House, you know, obviously this new Congress that comes in just a few weeks is going to be a bipartisan Congress, a Democratic House and a Republican Senate.
Well, Congressman Chris, what better time? And Congressman Chris, I'm afraid that, that speaking of time, we're out of time. But Representative Charlie Crist from Florida's 13th Congressional District and co-sponsor of the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Magna. Great to be with you.
And Kate Yoder, news editor for Grist, an online environmental news magazine. Kate, I'm sorry I ran out of time there with you, but thank you so much for walking us through this new proposal in Congress. Thank you. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.